Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is episode number 321 with Chase Jarvis.
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
Welcome everyone back to the School of Greatness podcast. I'm so glad that you're here today. If this is your first time, make sure to check out the rest of our episodes as well by subscribing to the podcast over on iTunes. And if you are a regular listener, thank you so much for checking out this episode. And make sure to share the love at lewishowes.com/321 to get the message out about this interview. I've got my good buddy on, Chase Jarvis, and Chase is well known as a visionary photographer, director, and fine artist. And as a photographic master, Chase has won numerous awards. He's been called one of the top 30 most influential photographers of the past decade. He is a widely sought-after presenter and has been a keynote speaker at Fortune 500 companies, top universities, TEDx conferences, and much more. He's also an extremely successful entrepreneur, having recently started one of the world's fastest growing online education companies, creativelive.com. I'm super pumped to introduce you guys to him. And here are some of the main things that we're going to be talking about and covering in this interview. First off, we talk about some of the insecurities that Chase has had his entire life and how they actually helped cultivate creativity for him. Then we talk about how to overcome a creative block and the things you can do to move forward when you feel like you're in that creative block space. Next, Chase talks about the importance of taking care of your health if you want to be a successful creative. Then we cover the three things that are hugely important to make great art and how to get into the zone to create awesome work consistently. All this and so much more on episode number 321 with the one and only Chase Jarvis. What's up, everyone? Welcome to the School of Greatness podcast. I'm here with my man, Chase Jarvis. Good to see you, man.
Super happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm pumped to be here. We're in your studio. This is a different setup. We're in LA downtown.
Yep.
You're filming for something right now called 30 Day Genius.
30 Days of Genius. Yeah, it's a series of videos on Creative Live. We're going to make sure this comes out at the right time because I haven't even announced this stuff yet.
So okay.
This is like,
well, what's the link going to be, just so we're aware?
creativelive.com/30 Days of Genius, the number 30 Days of Genius.
Okay, cool. We'll time it up and
yeah, for sure.
It's out there.
You go there and you click a button and then you get a badass interview every day for 30 days from
very cool,
game changing
creative.
Awesome.
We just did one, which was fun. So thanks for having me.
Hey,
having me on.
You're in the club, man. I appreciate it. Tight club.
Now, I'm curious for those that don't know who you are. I just told them a bio about you just before this, but for those that don't know who you are and your backstory, I'm curious, who is the most influential person of your childhood? And what was the biggest lesson they taught you?
The most influential person from my childhood. Wow. I'm going to cop out and say I got two people and it's my parents. I'm an only child.
Okay.
And, I think for a lot of people that means, spoiled, mm-hmm, but
entitled.
Entitled, spoiled. I can pretty much demonstrably say that wasn't the case for me.
Right.
I mean, I had upside down Nikes. I had Adidas with four stripes. Came from, humble middle class upbringing. But my parents were of the type of people who were very, very supportive. Mm. And in particular, they encouraged me to pursue what I wanted to pursue. That's not without a bunch of social pressure. I feel like that social pressure was less about family and more about culturally for me. We can talk about that a little bit later, but my parents played a huge impact in helping me create the life that I wanted. And I think there's a lot of heat, they unintentionally put heat on me to pursue those dreams.
Mm-hmm.
I'm super grateful for that heat now looking back. So
of course,
it was a very small, I have no cousins. I have no brothers and sisters. Wow. I'm an only child, and so there's nobody to carry on the driver's name after me. And so that's why they were so influential.
Interesting.
They're very small, like a little baby wolf pack.
Oh, right. I like it. Well, and who would you say is more influential?
Wow.
Who was more influential, and then which one taught you the most important lesson?
I think that they have taken turns at different times. I think when I was younger, so my dad was a cop.
Uh-huh.
And my mom worked in admin at a biotech company. My mom stayed home a lot when I was younger, and so she was very, very impactful for me. She's a neat freak. She's very, I'd say, organized, and she's very much a doer.
Right.
And so early in my career, early in my life as a youngin, that she was very, very influential. And then, a little bit later when I think, and this is also probably biological as well, I started, connecting more with my father because he was working basically, you know, he was building houses for us to live in during the day. And then he would work the night shift from literally, I think 2 in the morning until 11. So he was basically gone. I think I got that screwed up. So he was gone during a lot of my childhood working, as a cop. And then when I started, you know, graduating or getting further along in school and sports started to become a real big thing, my dad was always there
at the game,
you know, being very supportive. My mom was as well. But I think there's some correlation to biology as well.
What would you say is the biggest lesson then?
Wow. I think the lesson from my...
From like 5 to 18. Was there a big lesson that stands out?
I think there is a certain stubbornness. And you know, that cuts both ways. It's things like, I like double-edged swords.
Yeah.
But I think a desire for greatness, a desire to achieve. I've come to find out later in life that that's also a little bit of a crutch. You know, it's sort of a substitute for intimacy and a substitute for connection.
Right.
If you are just trying, we were talking about this at dinner last night with some of the crew who's sitting here in the room. If you are so great that if you get first place, it's really hard to argue with that person's ability or qualities or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so that was a defense mechanism. But the good side of that double-edged sword is I think my parents instilled that into me, which is, you know, success is often directly proportional to hard work. And I always put in the work.
What did you think was the biggest fear for you growing up? Did you have big fears?
I think the biggest fear for me, and like just total transparency, we're going there in this interview, I can tell already, but was... It was a specific question. It was
the biggest fear.
Biggest
growing
fear.
Up.
I think obscurity. Just like not being present in the conversation, whether that conversation is about greatness or just like being nothing.
Not being in the conversation.
Yeah, being nothing, being vanilla, being obscure.
Mm. Was that in like the teen years, or was that in college, or?
I think that was a theme. You know, I'm an extroverted person, generally speaking, although I feel like I'm getting in touch with my introverted self in this sort of second arc of my life. But early, it was very much about achievement, greatness, being successful. And again, you know, you have the book and the podcast, The School of Greatness, being great and lifting others up around you. And it's a very complex thing, being great, being a great leader, being a great doer isn't the whole picture, ultimately.
Yeah, of course.
And so I think there was a fear about the fear around being obscure and not being noticed or relevant, and then dramatically overcompensating by, you know, being the captain of a football team, the captain of the soccer team, and hanging out with the skate punks, and... You know, getting academic scholarship and getting an athletic scholarship, and how can you try and be great at everything so that you can silence all the haters? And ultimately, like that's kind of a not so awesome existence, trying to not achieve for the sake of achievement or sort of self fulfillment or actualization, but achieve to shut up people who might criticize you.
Right.
It's a different. It's the same result of greatness, but I believe deeply in the mentality of how you got somewhere.
So. Mm. You know, I had a lot of insecurities when I was in middle school, high school, even before then. I feel like I was very insecure and unsure of myself. What were your biggest insecurities?
Mm. One of the things that I have learned about myself is that I'm rarely aware of insecurities in the moment. I'm just living that sort of fear cycle or that conversation that goes on inside you. And then I'm only able to identify them by looking backwards. I think that's a saying. You can only connect the dots looking backwards. So as I try and connect the dots looking backwards, I think I was very insecure as a very young person. I wore glasses. And
did you need them?
I needed them because one of my right eye was developing much faster than my left eye.
Yep.
Doc says this is a problem. So in first grade, I think at the end of first grade, I got glasses, big, like foghorn, leghorn glasses. Like, you know, the cartoons would be fantastic if someone could see these pictures and draw them. So big, like tortoiseshell, thick glasses, from second to, I think, fifth grade, second or fifth or sixth. And I remember, like, oh, wow, you know, I had a little line of defense mechanisms. Like, someone would say, hey, four eyes. I would say, well, four eyes is better than two. I mean, just like little childish thing, but I could tell looking backwards that that had an impact on me. And I was really, attuned to it when in either fifth or early, I think fifth grade, I got them off. And all of a sudden, the girls came back into my life as a fifth grader, but I was like, I was very aware of that. Mm. But, so that would be one thing that I was very insecure about was my, my big ass glasses. And I was a jock. I was a high performer, even as a little tyke. I didn't know that I was good, but I would score more goals than anybody else. And it was weird to have big ass glasses and be playing basketball.
You're running. You had to wear them playing.
Yeah.
Context then.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was probably literally before context or that thing.
But yeah.
So those are some key, very young developmental, insecurities that I really wasn't aware of at the time.
Right. But, do you have any insecurities right now?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are they?
First
thing that comes to your mind?
First thing that's come to mind is, how to sound like I'm a professional speaker, basically. So how do you come off as authentic and have answers not be polished in podcasts like this?
Right.
Like my goal is, connection. I've tried to connect with people through my art for my whole entire artistic career. We've built a platform called Creative Live, whose sole goal is trying to connect people with their dreams and career, hobby, and life. We have millions of students all over the world. I think I'm really good at connecting with you, but I also don't want to come off as too heavy. My background is in philosophy. I went to school. I was in a PhD program in philosophy, so I can talk a lot and, I'm in my head a lot.
Mm.
Okay. So, and how do I sort of deliver value to your listeners? That's in the moment. So
that's a current insecurity is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, you said current. I'm trying to think like right now, like I want to add.
I mean, in your life in general.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right now, like I want to add as much value as possible in the next 45 minutes to your audience.
Right.
Personally right now, like larger life skills.
Yes. Do you have any insecurities in your life right now?
I think I stopped, let me rephrase that, about 18 months ago or 24 months ago now, 5 years ago, I founded a company called Creative Live and built it up very, very quickly, very successful.
How many employees do you guys have now?
About 120 employees.
Yeah.
And then about a year, 18 months in, I hired a CEO, a guy named Mika Solomon. He came in, did a great job. He was the former president of Viacom. $1 billion business. He'd had a $200 million exit before then. He came in and I learned a lot from Mika. But about 24 months ago, came time to raise a Series B. So I got really involved in the company again. And it became clear that I needed to come back and be the CEO of the company. So I moved Mika to the board very amicably. And I had always been a leader, a natural leader. I was the captain of every team I've ever played on. There was an employee that shortly after I came on, he'd been frustrated for a little while. He was on the product team and he left the company. He's like, okay, I just want to let you know I'm giving my notice and move on and do something different. And I was like, I asked him for a piece of feedback. What's a piece of feedback?
And for you?
For me personally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's something that I try and be really open and, accessible. And the feedback is he said, you've made a career out of leading people who are naturally prone to follow you because of what you've achieved. And in this new role as a CEO, you're leading other leaders. And those are different.
Wow.
And
interesting.
That was like a gong right on my forehead. That was like a wow. And it's a very different sort of role to be in. And I still consider, you know, my work as a photographer and a director still, you know, very alive and well. But my primary focus is very clearly on Creative Live and taking that to the next level. And so the ability or the requirement to step in and lead, as again, there's a natural skill set there for me, but to lead in a different way, lead other leaders.
As opposed to followers.
Yeah, yeah, I think
fans
sure. Fans or followers. And boy, it's a phenomenal challenge. And I think it's my biggest challenge. And it's something that I love. I'm putting a ton of energy into that. That's what's taking up my time outside of all the day-to-day decisions of, you know, running a 100-person, you know, venture-backed company. So
what have you learned about yourself since that feedback? You know, what have you applied or tried that you learned something new about yourself?
That I'm capable of it.
Yeah.
And I see glimpses of it, but I don't yet have it mastered.
Right.
And it's
welcome to the club.
Yeah. But it's so fun. You know, I go back to the earlier thing, confession about like a desire for mastery as a life.
Yeah.
Like in everything, like you just are the, if you're just crushing everything and you work super, super hard,
right.
Then you can silence all the haters. And so for me, going to town and doing the work to be a different kind of leader than I've been before at this, you know, at this point in my career is just a phenomenal challenge. I think I, honest, total transparency, I think I was resisting it early on.
Yeah, sure.
And just the opportunity to be open to new things. I think ultimately it's not ironic that one of my A, biggest skills, but B, biggest passions is lifelong learning.
Yep.
It's not a surprise that I created a company around lifelong learning.
Sure, sure.
So this has been my biggest challenge.
Wow. Okay. I love it. I'm going to step back one step and talk about insecurity, not with you, but this is just coming up from where as we were talking about this, because you are known for creativity. You're extremely talented artist, photographer, world class. A lot of people know about your work. How does insecurity cultivate creativity?
Love this question.
And hold artists back from being successful at the same time? As I'm thinking about it right now, insecurity actually drives a lot of people to being super creative, whether it be a musician or an artist or a photographer, but also I can see it holding them back. So
no, I love the question. I'm going to think for just a second.
And do you need insecurity to be a great artist?
I'll start with that one because that's easy. First of all, the things that made you weird as a kid, those perspectives that you were afraid of, like that actually makes you great. That like going there is part of the, that's the sauce that people can connect with. And you being bulletproof and perfect and all these other things that we try and be. And obviously there's no chance at that, but we posture. And those are all the things that sort of alienate and disenfranchise and create a division between you and your fans or followers and people who might love your work. So what made you weird and quirky? Those are your biggest strengths as an artist. So you said there are artists for whom insecurities drive success. Those are the artists that are willing and able to capture that and go there. And then there are artists who have the insecurities and the folks that when they stand off from those things, they are unable to connect with their audience. Mm. And I don't mean to say that some artists have it mastered and other artists are still on that journey. I mean to say even within one career, there are things where we are able to go there and tap into that weirdness that we have as a kid or that unique perspective. Mm-hmm. And then there are other times in the same life or same arc or maybe even the same album for a musician where you weren't able to really go there and you can tell it has this sort of veneer to it. So ultimately those things are so core to creativity. There's a designer, friend of mine named James Victori who I often quote. He says, in the particular lies the universal. So what is it about your particular situation right now that is a story that you could tell through a piece of art, through creating something that seems super, super focused and finite and very you-centric. But ultimately, those are the things that there's millions of people who have experienced that in some way, shape, or form, and that allows the connection. So.
Wow. So would you say that if you've achieved your success as an artist, everything you touch turns into millions or impacts people, that in order to continue doing that and being successful as an artist, and whatever success means to you, that you need to still be insecure? Or can you be completely secure in yourself?
No one's. I mean, I know a lot of super, super famous people that are crazy insecure.
Right.
And I think there's the belief that you've achieved success and success is overnight. It's the classic 10-year overnight success. I really don't know an artist who's ever made it in the classic sense, whatever it is, but I'll just go the cliche, made it.
Right.
Where, there wasn't 10 years hard work underneath that. I've often used the artist, Macklemore. He's a friend. Seattle guy.
Yep.
He was living in his basement when he sort of got, living in his parents' basement early on in his career. He just got out of rehab, and had been making music for 10 years before he was an overnight success.
Right.
He and Ryan Lewis got together, made an album. The album threw singles, and the album had, it was a 15X platinum album as their freshman album, the first album ever. And the belief is that, oh wow, that just happened. And there's always all kinds of hard work that's happening underneath the surface that people don't look. It's sort of like a swan, right? It looks calm on top, but underneath you're kicking like hell. And even that sort of level, again, keep pulling on this Macklemore thread. His next album is very much about exploring the insecurities that he had at the Grammys, winning 4 Grammys your first year, performing, artist of the year, album of the year, rap album of the year.
Being friends with every big celebrity.
Yeah, and overnight. Still just like want to crawl out of your skin when you're, you know, alone with yourself. So there's this dichotomy, and I don't think anyone's ever mastered it. And if they have, I don't know them. I haven't experienced it myself. It's more like, right? It's like waves. Like waves come and go, and waves are different size, and you catch some waves and you don't catch others.
Sure.
I'm really interested in this sort of arc of my life and around exploring our shadow selves, which is that side of us that we don't really want to look at or pay attention to, because it's like in there lies, I think, a lot of the answers to what we're dealing with right now.
Right.
Now, opportunities.
Now, did you ever have a corporate job starting out? Were you ever?
The job that I have right now sitting on this couch is the most corporate thing I've ever had.
But you went right into finishing school and being a photographer pretty much right away.
Yeah. Okay. And I should say that I felt, I think this may or may not, but may resonate with your listeners or watchers, because we're recording this here.
I guess the reason I ask, because I'm curious, is I was going to ask you, what did you do to transition from corporate life to being an artist? And so there's probably a lot of people listening who want to be more creative or want to do something on their own or like jump out into their art.
I get it.
What type of feedback or thought would you give them?
Let me tell a little story.
Yeah.
So I cited my parents earlier as big inspirations. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them completed college. They both started in some way, shape, or form. Ended up just putting food on the table and paying rent and raising a little tyke like me instead. But at some point, I believe that there is pressure from our parents, sort of endemic in the relationship between a offspring and a parent, that they want things for you. And then there's the cultural things, like what does success mean culturally? Is it monetary? Is it you're on TV? Is it you can provide for yourself and your family? Like there's all kinds of different things, but certainly not being a drug addict on the street, whatever the opposite of that is. Some sort of like when you're able to provide for yourself and the people you care for. And then there's what like greatness. You have the school of greatness. There's a lot of pressure to be great in the culture. And what ultimately ended up happening for me was I got stuck in this loop of what I was supposed to be. So I was very creative as a kid. Go back to my childhood. Very creative. Since I didn't have any brothers or sisters and, we lived in the suburbs, I was in the backyard, riding my bike, doing stuff pretty much solo. Had to come in. There was no kids table. There was only one table. So I had to sit with the adults, but very creative. And yet the kids in my school who were creative, it was like always talked about with that, with air quotes, like, oh, hey, so creative. I was like, I don't want to be creative. It's like, oh, there's, Sally in the corner. She's so creative.
Right.
So I basically went the opposite direction. I said, okay, well, what's the opposite of that? Oh, it's the jock or the captain of the football team or the whatever. And so I ran to that with everything. Oh, great. I can do that. That's this earlier sort of defense mechanism. And yet I had been sort of repressing this part of myself, this very creative, expressive part. And this continued on until, well into high school. Yes. The thing that saved me, I feel like, was skate culture. skate, surf, sort of. Because in that world, it was the first time I'd seen creativity and athleticism fused, where there's a lot of self-expression. I mean, we spray painted, we like music, music with the things, shot videos, express yourself through movement. Because I broke
the rules.
Yeah. There was a little bit of a rebellious sort of anarchist element to it, even if it was just play anarchy. But that gave me insight that, you know what? Wait a minute. This is the subculture that's come up that's made its own rules. And it was like a light switch went off. Like, wait a minute. The rules were made by nobody smarter than us.
Right.
And they're as random as which way the wind's blowing. And wow. So there's a paradigm for me to do the things that I want to do in life. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly, there is a grain and you do have to go against it.
Yeah.
Even with that knowledge, I went to college on a soccer scholarship.
Right.
Not dissimilar to you. It's like, okay, I obviously am going to become a professional soccer player because who wouldn't want to do that?
Right.
4.5 years into my college soccer career, I went to the team that, you know, the year I was, recruited, we lost in the national championship, division one, like top of the top. I was on the Olympic development team.
Wow.
And yet 4 years in, I'm like, I don't want to do this.
Not for you.
And it's very hard when something like you, and you have the opportunity to go do it. And everyone in the world would think you'd be nuts. Who wouldn't want to go play pro soccer? Are you kidding me?
Right.
And I had pathways to Europe, and that's where soccer was huge. It was still, you know, developing here in the U.S. And I had to say no to that.
Mm.
And I had to say no to it from inside first. And then breaking that news to my team, my coach, my parents, my family that was close to me, it was a very big deal. Follow on to the next thing is, well, then what else is... Oh, great. Well, I'm gonna get a degree. I'm gonna do pre-med because that's literally like, how can you make it so that there's no haters?
Right, right.
Just become a doctor. So I pursued this path of pre-medicine, got good grades, took the MCATs, was doing the interviews. And
wow,
the last second, not dissimilar to soccer, I was like, this is totally not for me.
Wow.
I had brought myself to the doorstep of that and was just ready to step over the threshold. Oh, no. And so I bailed on medical school. And then I said, wow, my parents, you know, my poor parents, right? Like pro athlete. Oh, doctor. Oh, yeah, that's cool. And then how about a different kind of doctor? I'll get a PhD in philosophy because I got really interested in the ability to think critically. And, I think there's a little bit of a brooding side to, philosophy and to, young artists. And so I was tapping into that. Like, oh, I'll be a philosopher. I'll get a PhD in philosophy because it's a doctor. It's a different kind of doctor. Right. Well, I'm 2 years into that. No, gotta quit. And what I wanted to quit to do was to go back to that creative roots, the stuff that I saw and tapped into through skate culture and that I had lived my whole life internally, but never really expressed. And so I stopped everything and I said, I'm going to become a photographer.
Wow.
And that was a like mind exploder for most of the people in my world, in my community, in my family.
What year was this?
Gosh, that would have been 1996. Young punk and realized, a handful of things happened to coincide. One, right at my college graduation, my grandfather, who was a hobbyist photographer, my father was as well. I was inspired by photography because as an athlete, I was often in the newspaper and I was articulate enough that I would be able to speak to the press for my team. And we were top 10 team in the country. So there's always, we were on television every right. week and I got to interface with the press. That gave me a sense of like, wow, photography isn't like just pictures. It's about stories and about moments. And there's this like, this is a beautiful story in this thing. So I started getting obsessed with that. And I mentioned both my father and grandfather were hobbyists. And my grandfather died about 4 or 5 days before my college graduation. Dropped dead of a heart attack, completely out of the blue. And obviously that was traumatic as hell. However, the silver lining is that I was given all his cameras. And
perfect timing.
It was incredible timing. And I packed my bags with my then girlfriend, now wife, Kate, and set off to Europe. And I walked the earth for 6 months.
Wow.
On a journey trying to find my will to say that I didn't want to do all of these other things that I had prepared for in life to become a doctor, to become a professional athlete, and I came back and basically quit everything that everybody else wanted me to do. I flirted with graduate school in that PhD program. With philosophy. And then said, F it. I've got one life. And I don't remember the actual moment. I think it was, during those travels that I had convinced myself that,
wow,
if you don't write your own script, someone else will write it for you. And I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't want someone else to write my script.
Interesting. Was there a moment before then where you realized what you were born to do? Do you remember a day or moment in your life where you're you learned this is why I was born?
I didn't, but I did have, I don't remember a particular moment, but I remember recurring visions. And the recurring visions were, I was on stage.
How old were you?
This is young. I mean, this is single digits. Mm-hmm. And it was when I was that age, I did not understand that. I understand, I was always, my parents were sharing this just the other day. My dad turned 70 tomorrow, so we're talking about what we're going to do for his birthday. And we were joking around. We went on family vacation to Ibiza, Spain, the club he joined. A long time ago. But I was into breakdancing as a young punk. And we were at this, in front of 2,000 people at this performance. And they said, anyone can get up on stage and dance.
Wow.
For just in the intermission zone up there and just started throwing down a windmill.
Wow.
And
it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
can you still do a windmill?
Yeah, I still got it.
No way.
I do.
I want to see it afterwards.
I do. You have to get married or some big life event, and then I will throw
or
down.
Or you have to get on the School of Greatest podcast.
There you go. Or, yeah. But I still got it. It's rusty, but I'm sure. And so there was always a little bit of a performance thing, on stage. And, I thought of it more about leadership than I did about, acting or performing. Mm. I didn't understand it then. It was just a thing that I was only able to connect the dots looking back, wow, that was always a piece. That was a thing.
Mm.
So
that's cool.
Present. Yeah. Yeah.
I like it. Let's talk about health and wellness. Why is, health and wellness so important for creatives? Obviously I think it's important for everyone, but
yeah.
Talk about it specifically for creatives.
Well, there's a story that our culture has manifested about how creatives are, they're these brooding souls. And if Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, if you live this tormented life, that your art is so real and so pure. And that's just fiction. That's a terrible thing that we've painted for our culture. And that's not to say that our artists, as a bunch don't draw inspiration from many places. And sometimes our struggles, are a key place. Like we talked about earlier, the things that made us weird and quirky and the things that were hard for us, that's a great place to draw inspiration and, universality and the message of the art. But the fact that that is required to create great art is absolutely a myth. The reality is, in fact, longevity and stamina and presence and all these things that are certainly not requirements, but increased in their level of manifestation when you're most alive, when you're most in tune with yourself, with the world around you. And it turns out that health is required for all those things, for that stamina. So that's, I'm glad you asked the question. It's a mission for me in particular to try and shed light on that. I think it does come out of the sort of the taking care of oneself, the sports background that we have in common. We've talked about a lot. You talked about it on your podcast a lot. We've shared those stories together.
Yeah.
I realized that sort of physical and emotional wellness, has this sort of, it creates a propulsion, an energy of vitality, that is, that at least for me is, it allows me, it becomes a vessel through which my art can move. And when I'm not living in those truths or with that sort of, amount of that integrity towards my health, I'm less creative. And I would love for our culture to sort of usurp that traditional vision of what it means to be I hate the term starving artist. I hate, troubled artist, all those kinds of things. I don't think we can't escape that. That's a thing. And that does produce great art because it's real emotions that are coming out. But, I just hopefully we can sort of, usurp and stomp out that that's required. In fact, I know so many, so many artists that come from, I'll just use the example, the cliched example of middle America, suburban, white, came from relative privilege, and I think there's a belief that, well, they don't have anything to say. And to me, being aware of your privilege is absolutely important, but that you don't have a message which is human and that your own life can't be a blueprint, from which great art can spring. To me, that's a really dangerous thing for us to sort of believe as a culture. Awareness of your privilege is absolutely, especially, you know, relative to other socioeconomic status, other, people in the world. That's awareness. It's not a requirement.
Right. Sure.
So let's stomp that out. I think Liz Gilbert, I don't know if you know Liz, she talks about having created her life's best work. I think she says best. She may have well created her best work when she wrote Eat, Pray, Love, which is X million books sold, you know, Oprah, she's on all that stuff. And her, I think she did a great TED talk following that, and certainly her next book around, wow, now what do I do?
Exactly.
Because it's quite likely.
Your best work is behind you.
It's quite likely I've created the best work of my life.
And I have
now what?
40 more years potentially to live or whatever.
Yeah, I've got a lot of vitality. I still have stories to tell. And so I identify with that, and I hope that, like the way we talk about it at Creative Live, is one of our sort of core visions is that creativity is the new literacy, and creative qualities are not an all-time high with, you know, we were just talking about, there's a robot camera we have here in the room shooting, but it's not as good as what TIFF's capturing on the
right side
of that lens right there, or that lens over there. And that, I don't know, just that creativity is so, so valuable. We talk about innovation. We're hungry for all these things, not just new products, but new way of unlocking human potential. And that those mechanisms are going to come from humans. And what if we could put as much energy into creativity and supporting that as a concept that we did put into literacy back, you know, in the post-Gutenberg press, 1400s. I mean, before that, it was called the Dark Ages for a reason. Like literacy provided, they were like life expectancy, all these things increased dramatically. The infant mortality rate went down. All these things changed when you could communicate ideas. What if we put that same amount of energy culturally into creativity? So I would prefer we shift towards that mindset culturally than that, A, there's not a creator of all of us, and artists are this weird disenfranchised bunch. And I think it's bearing true right now as all these things are at an all-time high.
Sure. When people say that they're in a, you know, a creativity block, or they feel stuck as an artist, or they're not able to put out the next best thing or whatever, what would you say is a good place to come from to facilitate creative ideas? Like, if I feel like I'm a writer's block or artist block, whatever it may be, I just can't take the right photos anymore.
I have no idea what you're talking about. It never happened to me.
What's something that someone could do, or in their business, you know, they're entrepreneurs, to, is there a process?
Can we get into this?
Do?
Like, let's get into this.
Let's do it, man.
All right.
Oh, I want another process.
So, I think having many solutions is the answer, and not that there's not one go-to thing that solves all things. So having a couple tools in your toolkit. Well, maybe, I don't know how many there's going to be. We're going to list them out though. There's probably a few. One of them is to have many things. So if you're a writer, you have a novel that you're working on, you have a short story, you have an essay, and then you have some poetry, and then you have a journal.
So you're not putting it all in one basket is what you're saying.
Yeah. And the reality is that on deadlines and things, you need to focus on the thing that you're trying to get it across. But even in those moments, having other activities within that same sphere of writing, say if you're a writer, we have many friends who are writers, and I think this works for many of those folks. I just read some study about the ideal number of creative projects to have if you're a designer. I think it was the lens through which it was the study was given. That five is the magic number. You need to have five things. I wish I was
working on it one time.
Yeah. And of course there are different levels of development, different levels of intensity. Writing in your journal is a lot less than,
writing a book.
Yeah. Than writing a book or a piece for the New Yorker or something, but having multiple things. So if you're blocked on one thing, shift gears, go to something else.
Interesting.
That's one tool.
I like that.
Another tool that I frequently embrace is get away from it. Like there's this desire, especially when you're a stubborn jackass like I am, to just like, nope, I don't care if it's 2 in the morning. I said I was going to finish this thing. I'm going to finish it. I'm going to push. And then you wake up or you decide, all right, I'm done. I'm like gibberish is coming out or my photographs, I'm editing them and it's not turning out the way I want. You walk away and you come back with fresh eyes. It's just unlocked. So like literally walking away from the thing that has you blocked. I would prescribe something in particular when you walked away. Sometimes it's just going to bed, like just giving up. But in particular, the way I talk about it is...
We're going to do something playful or fun, right?
Is get into adventures.
Yeah,
like cool. Do something that's very, very, very different. Often the act of play, it has many sort of solutions. I don't know if you're familiar with Charlie Hone. Do you know Charlie?
He's got a book called Play or...
Play It Away.
Play It Away, yes.
Yeah, and it's very much around sort of relieving anxiety and stress, and that it's just a huge missed opportunity and a manifestation for sort of human potential to play. We do it really well. It reduces stress, and it gets in touch with that most simple sort of crocodile human side of us and just joy.
Yes.
So what gives you joy? Go and do that thing. And sometimes that's, you know, I think a lot of people, when I say get into adventures, they translate that into like, all right, I got to go backpack through Europe for 6 months.
Well, right,
certainly that's a thing.
Go play some Frisbee for an hour.
Like literally go play some Frisbee for an hour, exercise, do something, get into an adventure, even if it's to go people watch. So to me, that's another thing is get away and get into adventures. I could probably keep on trucking, but there's just a handful of these and they're very simple. Like that's the thing the twisted irony is actually in the awareness that you're in that state. It's less about what you're going to go do to get out of it.
Gotcha.
So take up something else more creative. You're going to do all these different things, but the key thing is actually recognizing that you're blocked.
Hmm.
And when you're really aware you're blocked, you're like, that means you're super blocked. Cause it's not like, oh, I'm at the word. You're just like blank page.
Should you push through it, like you said? Is there ever a point where you're like, no, I'm just going to push through this, even if I can't?
Well, when you're on deadline and when you're a professional, let's pretend you're Phil Mickelson, the professional golfer. Random example. Sorry, I'm using golf. Nobody on the PGA or his sponsors really care how he's feeling today.
Right, right. He's just got
to
do it.
As a pro, you are paid to step up and hit the ball out of the park or hit the ball down the middle of the fairway or whatever your analogy is. And as a professional creative, very much the same is true. Like the people who are showing up on set to shoot a Nike commercial, for example, if you're not feeling it, it's like, oh, I'm not feeling it today because there's hundreds of thousands of dollars being spent all around you. You're actually paid to deliver. And so I do take a certain amount of pride in being able to produce creativity on demand. But that in and of itself is exhausting. It's not always there. So sometimes you do have to push through. But I think most of the folks in your community here for whom like being a professional creative at that level is not really the point that you're trying to make.
Right.
So pushing through, I think it's contextual. If you're a professional and you're on deadline, that's what you're paid to do. If you're not, then I would advocate one of those other things.
Sure.
Step away, get some other perspective. Involve, you know, we talk a lot about community too.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that whether you have a mentor, a friend, a partner in business, a team that you work with, the idea of bouncing ideas off one another and getting away and sort of getting unstuck is very powerful. Mm. The exchange of ideas, for me at least, and the people that I run around with, it's a powerful mechanism.
When you are, behind the camera and everything you shoot is like award winning. Like every photo is just like, wow, this is a masterpiece, which is probably all the time for you. But when that happens, when you're just in the zone, you're just like, man, this shoot, anything I click, it turns into magic. Like they could use any one of these photos and it would be on a billboard.
Yeah.
What is, how do you get in that zone? Like what is that? How do you facilitate that for yourself? Or is it just, happens when it happens for you?
I think it's pretty intentional.
Mm.
And, you know, go back to the life of, this is an area where I think I want to split hairs for your audience because let's talk about, like, you're asking the question to me on your podcast. So for me, who is a professional creative and has spent their whole life creating in many times on demand in very pressured situations where hundreds of thousands of dollars are being spent on that particular day. And if you don't get the job, you don't, not only do you not succeed at this job, but no one calls you.
Your reputation is gone.
Yeah, because the people, the level of people who do that work is very small, and that circle is a small circle. So you have made a career out of delivering. I believe that there's you're certainly hotter and colder But Roger Federer is hotter and colder, but Roger Federer is still Roger Federer.
He's still the top.
Yeah. And it's very much about going to what you know. Mm. And that has to do with sort of routines and beliefs and self-talk, I think, is very important.
What do you say to yourself before every shoot or project? Or
I visualize success for everything. I think Ira Glass talks about this thing called the creative gap, which when you're first starting out at something, what you see in your mind, like, oh man, I want to make this particular photograph, or even build a business. I want to build a business that looks like this. And then you set out, you invest a year of your life to create this business, or a week of your life or a day of your life to create this particular picture. And the gap between what you see in your mind and what you're actually able to create is the creative gap. Mm. And through repetition, practice, skill, self-talk, visualization, the goal is to move those things closer and closer, that what you saw in your mind and what you're actually able to produce. And as a professional who, is paid to hit the ball down the middle, is paid to create great things for, whether for inspirational companies or for myself.
Right.
When that gets to zero, and that the creative gap is zero, I believe that I can make the things that I see in my mind now. I have the tools, I have the resources.
Experience. Everything.
Yeah, the experiences. And being like, that is the zone that you get in over the course of a decade.
Yeah.
Certainly years, but you know, I think it was probably a decade before that was zero for me. And then there's a new game that starts all over again, which, what is the thing that you will be building?
Yeah.
Cause it used to be, I want to be able to make a picture. And for me now, it's like, what is the most compound thing? I want to make a picture and I want to tell a story about making the picture. And then I'm on both sides of the camera. I'm shooting and I'm like in the campaign.
Producing.
And
then,
It's like, I try and sort of build up a level of complexity. And how do you manifest that, or how do you build companies like Creative Live is a project for me. So
what does visualization look like for you then on a daily basis? Is it a daily basis thing? What is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Visualization for me started as an athlete. I, as I mentioned, went to college on a soccer scholarship, and colleges are basically laboratories. You know, we had trainers that were, you know, taking care of us, and they're in school, but they're taping our ankles every day. And, you know, the training staff that's learning to be trainers is actually taking care of the student athletes. And, and one of the vehicles that we were exposed to was sports psychology. The act of sort of visualizing the outcomes that you wanted. I dabbled in it in high school, and I had one experience that was a life changer for me.
Really?
And that was, I knew that, going to college and getting a soccer scholarship was, important to me. I had the same option for football. And visualizing the outcome that I wanted at the end of the season. And where I went to school, soccer, football was in the fall and soccer was in the spring, so you could actually do both, which was very different than most other places in the country.
Sure, the same time.
Usually the same time. But, for me, I started dabbling with this visualization in football, and I saw myself, you know, scoring touchdowns and intercepting, you know, passes and things that were prudent to the positions that I was playing. And I sort of was a little bit lazy about the practice, but I realized that I was manifesting these things. I realized that I didn't score the number of touchdowns that I wanted, but I actually intercepted the same number of passes that I saw at the beginning of the season at the end. Wow, that's interesting and powerful.
So you declared a number that you wanted to intercept.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah. And, you know, and all state or whatever, then I need to hit these numbers to be able to have colleges interested in offering me a football scholarship. And that worked. But I saw it very sort of nebulously, and it was so powerful. And then I was like, wow, what if I really apply this?
Huh.
So I spent the time between my football season and soccer season, like reading about visualization, going to workshops, anything I could find and get my hands on. The literature was pretty lean at that time. This is literally pre-internet.
Right.
And it was so powerful. I scored exactly, you know, the number of goals. I actually sadly don't even remember what it was. I remember just being, holy crap. Wow. I scored exactly the amount of goals I thought. And I ended up choosing to go to college on a soccer scholarship instead of football. That was very powerful. And then when we got the opportunity to apply that at the collegiate level with trained professional psychologists, I was like, this visual, there's something here, this sort of putting it out there in the universe, creating a narrative around what you have achieved. And you talk about this a lot in your book, in School of Greatness, and certainly on the podcast. Building things with the end in mind, setting goals is the way you talk about it. And so visualizing now, the outcome of a shoot or the outcome of building a company or success milestones with Creative Live, I very much intentionally sit down and do that every day. In fact, I have 10 things that I do every day, and I track them with an app called Habit List. And one of those is, I put these, it's really two things that I smush together, gratitude and visualization. And I do it immediately following meditation in the morning. Wow. I meditate every 20 minutes every morning and every evening. And just immediately following transcendental meditation, I spend somewhere around 5 minutes with a gratitude practice and then visualizing the things that I want to happen in the world. And some of those are around the outcomes of shoots and making things. Some of them are around relationships and personal development. It's just a powerful tool.
I love that, man. Yeah. What's the app called?
It's called Habit List.
Habit List.
Hey,
you have
for those
10 things on there?
Yeah, I just have 10 things on there, and I track this behavior. I track 10 behaviors. And I do that instead of actually saying, like, I want to be able to, you know, bench press 250 pounds or run a 4:440 or whatever the thing is. It's if I do these things every day at the level that I've written here, it's there's almost no chance of not achieving that
results.
Goal.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that, like, for me, that's a different thing than just being outcome focused, because then it's sort of like you can ring the bell, but then you go back to being, you know, your slovenly self or your, I seek to create habits habits stick, I feel like.
That's great. Yeah. Final few questions. What's something that's non-negotiable for you that you do every day? Besides those 10 things, I guess.
Besides those 10 things? Wow.
Something that's
I gotta dip into number 11, 12, and 13.
What's a non-negotiable for you, though, that's like really important, you must do it every single day? It could be, you know, one thing, a few things, but it's like every day I have to do this, no matter what.
I think meditation.
Why?
Meditation for me has become, it's the single biggest game changer for me in my adult life. Gave me the ability to sort of tap into the oneness. I'm looking at you and you're Lewis Howes and I'm sitting over here. But the way I think about it when I'm in that still place is that we're absolutely 100% connected. And whether it's energy or there's all kinds of different ways that we are the same.
Right.
There is no other.
Hmm.
And that sort of the unifying feeling that creates is a very powerful way to start the day. It makes things like intention and, the best analogy for me is, I don't know if you've ever heard interviews with Michael Jordan, but Michael Jordan talks very clearly about, playing the game of basketball, and it appears in slow motion for him.
Yep.
And so he's able to very easily see what the right choices to make are, where to pass the ball, whether to shoot or not shoot. And meditation has that experience for me. There's this sort of a calming, a unifying, a simplifying, such that when challenging things come to you, you're presented with a very clear path, a clear decision.
Yeah, that's great.
For what you should do. And I feel like this, you know, I've shared this with, you know, other friends that we have in common. And there's a real paradigm there of it being a powerful thing. So that's something that I can't not do. I think maybe there's 5 days in the last 2 years that I haven't meditated.
Wow.
2 or 3 years. I'm freakish about it.
Mm.
Sometimes it's not always 20 minutes. Sometimes it's not always in the morning and the evening. That's my target.
Sure.
But, and I got 20 minutes this morning.
That's good.
I only got 10 minutes yesterday morning and I was okay with it because something's better than nothing.
Sure.
So meditation would be that without a doubt.
I love that. Okay.
But I don't want to be preachy and weird. You don't got to meditate. It's fine. It's just for me, singularly the most powerful device that I have experienced in my adult life.
And what made you want to try it out? Or
I think it had very much to do with the spiritual side of what I experienced in visualization. To me, those things were very tied together.
But you just started the practice two or three years ago?
Right? I think I'm about between 4 and 5 years
in. Okay, cool, gotcha.
4 years in, 5 years in. But again, as I mentioned earlier, I'd flirted with the visualization concept through sports.
Meditation is very similar to just visualization.
And there's many different types of or meditation. I've tried several, and one in particular, several didn't stick, and one did stick, and that was the transcendental meditation.
That's great.
And what was the question? You had another question. It was a follow-on to that.
What made you want to start it?
Oh, yeah. Meditation. I think it very much was the...
The visualization stuff?
I experienced power, like fundamental human sort of genesis power, like, wow, the power to create the life that you want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about creativity and like what you're going to make, and you're going to take pictures, you're going to build businesses, but also there's the power to create your own life.
Yeah.
I feel also I'm personally not religious in the classic sense, but I'm very spiritual, and trying to reconcile those two things when I'm move through the world, and I don't identify with any one particular religion, but I see the synthesis of all of the religions and how there are basically many different angles on the same topic, and craving something to tap into. And that, you know, it's the underlying sort of the energy of the world. And this gave me access to that in a way that felt really natural and in touch with myself.
Cool. What are you most grateful for in your life recently?
My wife, Kate. She has been my sort of spiritual guide. She's helped me sort of understand a lot of these things. I think I'm a classic extroverted type A male. And for a long time, I believed that everything I had came from that.
Yeah.
And so why would I want to give that up?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, she was the one who really moved me into meditating, to trying this meditation with her around transcendental meditation. And that unlocked so many things to me that made me in part realize that the thing that I thought was my edge that had got me all of this success or any success that I'd had in my life, certainly caused me a lot of pain, but success came from being this sort of aggro, intense dude. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to find out since then is that actually that level of intensity and aggro was an anchor.
Mm.
And in sort of finding this sort of balance and this peace, that everything in my world accelerated.
Mm.
And that was a aha moment or aha 5 years worth of moments. And I attribute, there's personal work involved for sure, but I attribute the desire to embrace that personal journey to my wife, Kate, she's awesome. I know she'll listen to this because she's always tapping into these things, but Kate's great.
That's cool. What's something small that you've done or something that people don't know about you, you've done that you're really proud of?
When I move through the world on a daily basis, I help strangers. I seek helping strangers. Mm. And these are things that nobody knows about, acts of kindness. And it almost feels weird talking about it right this second. Mm-hmm. I just realized I had a little bit of a pang of anxiety right there because is it somehow tarnishing those things? But I think I come across, you know, I've always got my headphones on. I'm always on my phone and there's sort of an intensity and I preach the hustle. I'm anxious talking about it, but
I
help strangers put their bags in the overhead compartments.
Sure.
On the airplane, I fly like 3 or 4 times a week. I help.
Why do you do these things?
When I see someone who's in trouble, I go to help. I've caught burglars breaking into other people's houses.
Wow.
I don't know. I feel a sense of connection. And I think there's probably something in there that when I'm doing it to strangers, it's a little bit of an avoidance of intimacy with like the people that are really real and close to me.
Right.
And this is the way to sort of check a still doing good things for the world box, you know, in total transparency and openness. Maybe that's going on, but I delight in small gifts to strangers.
That's cool. I like that. Okay, this is the question I told you about before. Most people don't tell this question to, but if everything is erased from time that you've ever created, any photo, book, creative life is gone, this is 50 years from now, it's all erased, and you have a piece of paper to write down 3 truths that you know to be true about what you've learned in life that you would pass on to people, what would you write down?
I had an awesome answer earlier, and I'm not going to lie to you. I'm just gone, but I think I'm going to be able to get there. So the first is love. I think that love is a solution to every human problem. Mm. Integrity is, to me, a foundation of how to move through the world. And these are all things we all come in and out of for sure, but I think this is these are truths. Love, integrity, and creativity. I think the human spirit is very, very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. And there is a creator in all of us. And using that power for good would be something that I would want anyone who's left on this planet in a post Chase Jarvis world to take to heart, to create, to create great things. I think the answer that I had before might have been a little bit better, but that's what's upon me right now. Love,
integrity.
Integrity and creativity.
I love it. Okay. Before I ask the final question.
Wasn't the final question?
No.
Oh man, I was like,
before I ask the final question.
Past.
where can we connect with you online?
Not dissimilar to Mr. Lewis Howes. I'm basically sort of Chase Jarvis
everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. I'm super passionate about Snapchat right now. I'm having a lot of fun. It's a relatively new platform for me. I have a longstanding YouTube channel. It's got more than 250 videos there, tens of millions of views. Creative Live is, I think, the single most powerful thing that I've ever been a part of creating. Yeah. I get to go to work with 120 super talented, hardworking people who are dedicated to creativity and helping other people live their hopes, dreams, and fears and manifest great things for themselves.
Yeah.
The Creative Live is, you know, I'd put that before my personal stuff, but I feel like I just had the connection with, we have the Chase Jarvis moniker for everything.
Sure.
So you can find me online at the Chase Jarvis handle, but please, if you do one thing, go to Creative Live.
Yeah, it's a great site.
And there's 1,500 classes from the world's top creatives and entrepreneurs. People like yourself, Tim Ferriss, a lot of people who've been in this podcast have classes at Creative Live. And it's a place to get great inspiration and help unlock your creative potential.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, before I ask the final question.
Oh my God, they keep coming. You know this, don't you? You edit the... Christine is sitting across from me. She edits Lewis's podcast. And she knows all this is coming. I'm just falling right into your trap. Right into the trap.
There's one more question before I ask it. I want to acknowledge you, Chase, for your friendship. I want to acknowledge you for the incredible friend that you are to me, but to so many people. And you open up possibilities in everyone you interact with. You open up creativity. You open up love in so many people. And I want to acknowledge you for your consistent dedication to bringing education to the world in the format you're doing it. It's really expanding and allowing so many people that weren't able to create the lives they want to now have it because of what you're doing. So I acknowledge you for all those gifts.
I am grateful for your acknowledgement. Thank you, buddy. I don't take it lightly.
Yes. And the final question is...
final.
Is what's your definition of greatness?
Lewis Howes. My definition of greatness is living the life that you desire. I feel very wary of putting particular milestones out there. Mm. To me, there's so much subjectivity in the world that the life that you envision for yourself and the people near you, if you are on that path, then that is great. I hope it's got love in there. I'll just throw it in there.
Sure.
Love in your heart and living the life that you imagine for yourself.
Chase Jarvis. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, buddy. Bye, people.
There you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this episode with my good buddy Chase. If you did, make sure to share this out and give him some love over on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, all at Chase Jarvis over on Twitter and Facebook. Tag him, let him know what you think. And again, you can watch the full video interview over on YouTube or go to lewishouse.com/321. And if you're not a subscriber of our YouTube channel yet, we just hit over 50,000 subscribers. So thanks to those who are. And again, if you're not, make sure to subscribe because we do weekly videos, either interviews or inspiring videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So make sure to subscribe there and get inspired every single week. That's it for this week, guys. Thank you so much for your generosity, your love, your warmth, and your sharing of this information. It means the world to me. We're getting over 1.2 million downloads a month, and it's because of people like you. So make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, share it out with your friends if you found this valuable, and let me know what you think over on social media. I love you guys. Thank you so much for being here. And you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.
At Metro, get an iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system for $99.99. Take amazing pictures and share them instantly. And don't put up with life's yada yada.
Yada yada.
Like photo bombers. Zoom, crop out,
yada yada,
and bye.
You don't take yada yada in life, don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Get iPhone 12 with 5G with no activation fees and nada yada yada. Only at Metro by T-Mobile. Switch to Metro, bring your ID. This offer isn't available for customers currently at T-Mobile or that have been with Metro in the past 180 days.